a journalist in a Trump tweet storm today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Journalist Julia Yaffe recently wrote about Donald Trump's wife, Melania, and then this happened.
I woke up yesterday morning to find that the Daily Stormer, which is a white supremacist website, wrote a piece saying that I had attacked Empress Melania, the wife of their glorious leader. Their words, not mine. And they basically asked everybody to send me a tweet.
And the tweets they sent her were hateful. Plus, a kid moves from Cameroon to Maine. She takes a traditional lunch to school, chicken in peanut sauce.
And I opened it. I remember the kid across from me looked at me and just said, "Pew-wee," and got up and walked away.
The stories, plus a bunch of Berlins today on The World. Thanks for being here this Friday. We report on the Middle East a lot on the show, and most days there's a lot of breaking news to cover, like the broken down ceasefire in Syria. We're going to stay in the region today, but changing up the story list. Coming up later, getting Metallica to jam with musicians from Afghanistan. Yeah, big change. And to kick things off today, another musical story that's been pretty huge in Lebanon and Jordan this week. This is the Beirut-based band Mashru Leila. They got together at the American University of Beirut nearly 10 years ago. Mashru Leila is the only band in the Mideast that has members who are openly gay, and their audience knows them as LGBT-friendly. The band had been scheduled to perform tonight outside of Amman, Jordan, at a historic Roman amphitheater there. They'd played there before, but earlier this week, the band was told they no longer had permission. Then today, Jordanian authorities changed their minds, but the band said it was too late for them. Firas Abu Faker is Mashru Leila's lead guitarist. He told me about the original decision to block his group's performance.
The organizer in Amman received an official letter from the Ministry of Tourism stating that the license to use the Roman amphitheater has been revoked because our music is at odds with the authenticity of the ruin of the site.
And did they explain why that was a problem with this concert, but it had not been a problem in the past because you've played there before?
Yeah, no, there was no real explanation. In the following hours after the statement and the next morning, several statements were made in the media by government officials and by religious authorities in Jordan saying that our music and our lyrics are at odds with what they consider Jordanian tradition and customs and the values of Jordanian society.
Specifically, any lyrics that they cited?
Yes, they were kind of focusing on one particular song called Jinn. Jinn in Arabic means kind of like a spirit or a demon of sorts.
A ghost almost, right?
Yeah. And obviously for us what's interesting, you know, lyrically, poetically, is the wordplay between the spirit and the, you know, the alcoholic beverage, and so the song is kind of like describing some sort of evening in a forest with lots of drinking and kind of having a party.
I mean, your band, it's well known. You are LGBT-friendly, and members in the band are openly out. Do you think that played into this kind of cancellation initially?
I mean, we can speculate. I think definitely the topics that we kind of tackle in our songs are controversial. I guess some members of the Jordanian authorities saw them as maybe problematic to the youth in Jordan. What's funny is that, you know, we're not the creators of these topics. We didn't invent things like the freedom of speech or sexual liberties. And, you know, people have access to these topics through basically everything in society today. So it's kind of a funny story. And what happened was the main attack was on the lyrics and kind of taking a few words out of context of the song, out of the creative vessel of music, and using it to say that we are worshipping devils or calling for the worship of devils or something really ridiculous like that.
So now this decision has been reversed. No less than the mayor of Amman, Jordan, and the governor of the province around the capital say Mashru Leila is free to play now. But I gather that it's too late to start the concert as scheduled tonight.
It is too late to have the concert tonight, but I mean, we're happy to say that, you know, the first steps to to making another concert happen are underway. And obviously the pressure from the press, from the media, from our supporters in Jordan and the Arab world and beyond had a big role to play, I think, in having this decision reversed.
Firas Abu Faker, guitarist for Lebanese indie rockers Mashru Leila. Firas mentioned Jin, the song that some objected to in Jordan. Here's a taste of that. Now to a story that involves both what's happening in the Middle East and domestic politics here in the U.S. I'm talking about the federal program to resettle Syrian refugees here in the United States. And Kansas Governor Sam Brownback saying this week that his state is quitting that program. Brownback blamed the Obama administration for failing to provide adequate security assurances. My colleague Jared Goyette has been following the story for us, and we've got him on the line from Minneapolis. Jared, tell me more about why the Kansas governor has made this decision. What's behind the move?
What it comes down to is that the governor doesn't trust the vetting process for refugees, in particular for Syrian refugees. Now, that is an extensive process. It involves the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, intelligence agencies. It usually takes a few years, but Kansas, or at least the governor, are concerned that it's not adequate. I spoke with the governor's spokeswoman, Eileen Holly, and I asked her why.
This is about Kansas not participating actively in a program that we believe could put Kansans at risk. It's that simple.
You know, I've encountered a lot of people, and they are pretty well informed generally, and they don't understand the refugee resettlement process and the security that's built into the system. It is clearly mapped out, though, Jared, and the White House website even has a very detailed schematic of how it all works. How much reassurance does Kansas actually want?
Well, in this case, they're asking specifically for all of the documents pertaining to each refugee so that they can, I guess, double check it, if you will. But the State Department has refused to provide that because they say that it would be illegal under federal regulation and violate the privacy that refugees are promised as part of that process.
President Obama has said he wants to open America's doors to 10,000 refugees from Syria. How many Syrians have been resettled in Kansas so far?
It's about five so far this year, at least.
Five? One, two, three, four, five.
Yeah, there are more refugees from other countries like Bhutan, Congo, Burma that ends up in Kansas. But there are a small group of Syrian refugees, and they've been reluctant to talk to the press because of the scrutiny that they feel that they're under.
Refugees from Syria and elsewhere, are they going to be prevented from resettling in the state of Kansas in the future? Is that the bottom line here?
No, not at all. The funds that go to assist refugee resettlement are federal funds, not state funds. And now that Kansas is bowing out, a private contractor will just administer the program. I spoke to the International Rescue Committee, which is on the ground there, and they're going to continue providing services to the refugees that are there without stop. I also spoke to Sandrine Lisk. She's the director of an immigrant advocacy network in Wichita, and she sees something else is happening here.
This withdrawal actually has no impact on where refugees get settled by the federal government or those that are already here. I mean, some refugee could move here from New York. Governor Brownback has no say over that. So other than pandering to his base to say, you know, he's talking tough on terrorism and he's trying to protect Kansas, this doesn't even make any sense.
Wow. And what about refugees who already live in Kansas, Jared? How is all this kind of sitting with them? I know you spoke with a woman from Congo about this.
It doesn't affect them directly. If they're receiving services, they're still going to receive services. And in the case of Sonia Inamugisha, the Congolese woman I spoke with, she's worried about how she's going to explain this to her children.
If the government itself doesn't like you and doesn't want you to be there, what protection are you going to have? Why am I not welcomed here?
Yeah, a question I imagine on the minds of a lot of people in Kansas who face this. Why am I not welcome here? Jared Goyette with PRI.org. Good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
For a lot of immigrants, there are many different degrees of feeling welcome. And for immigrant kids, what happens at school is key. My WGBH colleague, Marcel Hutchins, was born in Cameroon and moved to Maine with her family when she was 8 years old. One of her first introductions to American life happened at lunchtime in her elementary school cafeteria in eastern Maine. She brought traditional Cameroonian food for lunch and immediately got a reaction. Marcel, hey, thanks for being with us. So what did you bring for lunch and what exactly was the reaction from your classmates?
It was peanut sauce. My mother still to this day makes it peanut with chicken, you know, mixed in with a bunch of seasonings. And I brought along rice on the side. And I remember walking into the cafeteria, not knowing anybody but my lunch and myself. And we sat down and I opened it. I remember the kid across from me looked at me and just said, "Pew-wee," and got up and walked away. I just continued to eat my food. And I remember another kid walked by and looked over and he said, "Ew, that's stinky. What's that?" And I just said, "My mommy's food." And he said, "What is in it?" And I said, "Chicken and peanut butter." And he said, "Ew, peanut butter? Why are you eating peanut butter with chicken?" And I still was just so baffled by that. And I didn't answer him. And I finished eating my lunch by myself. The next day, I bought a poulet de jay. I'm not sure if you're familiar with poulet de jay.
It's a chicken something.
Yes, it's chicken and plantains mixed in. And I brought that to school and I thought that smelled less than my peanut sauce. And it was the same thing. And they kept calling my food stinky. And then another kid came over to me and started asking me questions about Africa. You know, do your family throw spears around? Do you guys swing from tree to tree?
You're 8 years old when this is all happening.
I'm 8 years old, yes.
So how did you react to all this?
I was really quiet and really shy, and I was so homesick. I was missing Cameroon. I just wanted a familiar face, and I couldn't find one in the crowd.
Were you still bringing Cameroonian food, like peanut sauce, to school?
My mom would still pack it, but I threw it out.
Oh, no. So what were you eating instead?
I wasn't eating a whole lot. And so I went into the cafeteria one day, and it was Sloppy Joe. And I sat down and I looked at it. It was horrible. I couldn't believe this is what I was about to eat. And I started just slowly nibbling, you know, the Sloppy Joe, just tiny little bites. And finally, one of my classmates came over and she looked at me and she apologized. And she said, "You shouldn't sit alone." And she sat with me and she just looked at me and she started asking me questions about my country and Africa. And she said, "I know it's not true that your family don't swing from tree to tree, right?" And I said, "No." And she said, "I know you guys don't hunt lions, right?" And I said, "No." And after that, people sort of started looking at me differently because one person came over and started talking to me and the rest followed.
Marcel, you've discovered that some schools are now offering the food to line up with their multinational student body. Where is that happening?
From my research, it's happening right now in Boston or Massachusetts. I spoke to this guy named Alex Friedman who created this guide for schools who were interested in bringing culturally relevant food into their lunch menus. And he created this guide last year. And a number of schools in Massachusetts, but also in Minneapolis, are incorporating these menus into their lunch menus is what I found. And I was really happy to know that.
Did you ever manage to convince your classmates in Maine when you were a kid to try your food from Cameroon?
I did. And, you know, they changed it to the point where I just thought, no more. I don't want to bring my friends home if they're going to add ketchup to my mother's peanut sauce. Who adds ketchup to peanut sauce?
Oh, no. What's there not to love about peanut sauce? Marcel, we've got your story about this at PRI.org. And can I just say that picture of you as a young student in Maine in the fedora and fingerless gloves, so adorable.
That was always my style.
Great style. Journalist Marcel Hutchins, based here in Boston. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Afghan Rockers on a mission to play with Metallica. That's coming up later right here on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs for answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the future of finance to the disruptive potential of artificial intelligence. Tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
Here are a couple of lines you hear all the time when American politicians talk about the Middle East. The United States stands with Israel, and Israel is America's most important ally in the region. But there's no doubt the relationship is strained big time after years of disagreements between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So strained, in fact, that right now, Washington is offering Israel the biggest military aid package in U.S. history, and the Israelis don't like it. Zach Fryer-Biggs is on the story for Jane's Intelligence Weekly.
Israeli leaders and defense officials are providing all kinds of anonymous quotes to Israeli media about how really they need roughly $5 billion a year to maintain the qualitative edge. Now, they don't want to do that publicly because if they do and they get less than the $5 billion, which seems likely, then they have on the record indicated that they are no longer going to be able to maintain an edge. Supposedly part of the argument over pushing military aid is that Israel's interested in buying some additional hardware. The F-35 program, the JSF, the most expensive weapons program in the history of mankind, is going to be a big part of this deal as Israel looks to buy a bunch of fighter jets. So what they're trying to do is pull other levers to convince the U.S. to go above what the initial offer seems to have been, which was about $40 billion.
What kind of leverage does Israel have to reject this deal?
The underlying leverage that Israel has is that the notion of a military edge is no longer up for debate. It's not only policy, but it's enshrined in law. And with that being the case, the trading that's occurring is more about underlying dollar figures, because obviously U.S. politicians can't be seen to have failed to provide Israel with what it needs to defend itself, both from a public relations point of view and from the perspective of failing to comply with existing law.
How much does the U.S. need Israel in 2016, and what is really at stake here, in your view?
You know, I think that this is less about, from a military perspective, how much Israel can provide in terms of capability. The U.S. is going to go after ISIS, and it's going to worry about its own regional interests without expecting an enormous amount of military assistance from Israel. But Israel still has enormous political influence within the U.S., obviously, and we've seen that in some of this negotiation with those outside forces trying to push the total figure higher. So I'm not sure the U.S. fully needs Israel from a military perspective, but from a political perspective, no U.S. leader can possibly try to run the country without the notion that they are firmly supporting Israel.
So how long can Netanyahu negotiate on this and play around with this package? Is he just can he wait for possibly a Republican president to come in?
There's no reason he couldn't. The current deal doesn't expire for several years, and the idea has been floated that Netanyahu is going to try to push this into the next administration. Personally, that seems like more of a threat than anything else. It seems like a means to try to gain leverage, especially given President Obama's efforts to improve relations with several countries in the region following the Iran deal. He clearly wants to be able to have this deal in place as part of his legacy.
Zach Fryer-Biggs, senior Washington reporter for Jane's Defense Weekly. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Israeli-born author Ayelet Waldman is known for her frank essays and books on love, motherhood, and abortion. And she's upset some people along the way. She's likely to do that again with her latest project. Waldman and her husband, novelist Michael Chabon, are editing a book of essays coming out next year to mark 50 years of Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Reporter Daniel Estrin sat down with Waldman on a recent trip to the region to talk about her complicated relationship with Israel.
Ayelet Waldman left Israel with her family when she was just a few years old. But Israel didn't leave her.
For most of my life, I loved Israel. I longed for Israel. I planned to live in Israel.
She grew up in the U.S., but in high school, she spent summers in Israel. She spent her junior year abroad in Israel. After she graduated from Wesleyan, she moved to Israel to live in a kibbutz.
And that's when the cracks started in the wall.
As a feminist, she noticed there wasn't true gender equality on her kibbutz. She moved back to the U.S. and enrolled in Harvard Law School. She was in the same class as Barack Obama. She became a federal public defender for a few years, representing drug dealers and bank robbers. Eventually, she became a writer. As her political consciousness grew, she says, she couldn't stand reading about Israel's treatment of the Palestinians.
The more I learned, the less I could tolerate thinking about Israel. And I really did spend the next 20 years just trying to put it out of my mind. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu would be in the news and I would curse him, and that's about as far as it got.
Things changed 2 years ago when Waldman was invited to a writers' conference in Jerusalem. She went on her first trip to the West Bank city of Hebron. What she saw shocked her. The reality of many hardline Israeli settlers living among a Palestinian urban population.
This graffiti, these horrific, this graffiti, you know, death to Arabs, vicious, angry thugs wearing yarmulkes. I mean, they're thugs. Like, and I know from thugs, I was a public defender. Like, I know what a thug looks like. I know what a bully looks like. I know what a criminal looks like. Those are thugs.
When she left Hebron, she visited Israeli writer friends in liberal cosmopolitan Tel Aviv, and she felt at home with them.
And it was the moment of feeling at home with them that brought me to the crisis. Because if I feel at home with them, if I feel like I have a like I'm somehow connected to this place, well, then now it's my problem. Now it's my responsibility. I can't just go home and forget about it like I did for 20 years. Now I actually have to do something.
She and her husband, Michael Chabon, have invited novelists from around the world to come to the Palestinian territories and write essays about what they see. 24 authors are participating, including Geraldine Brooks, Dave Eggers, Rachel Kushner, Lorraine Adams, Tash Awe, and Mario Vargas Llosa. I recently joined Waldman and other writers going through security checks to enter an Israeli military court. It's where Palestinian teenagers appear before a judge, accused of offenses like carrying a knife at a military checkpoint or throwing stones at Israeli cars. As a former public defender, it's a topic that interests Waldman. She's writing about it for the Book of Essays. The book project is organized in part by Breaking the Silence, an Israeli veterans group that's controversial here because it's critical of Israel's occupation of the West Bank. And Waldman herself has stirred up controversy among some American Jews on Twitter this month, drawing rebukes from prominent journalist Jeffrey Goldberg. I asked Waldman if what she writes for the Book of Essays will alienate some of her American readers.
My parents raised me on this concept, this Hebrew concept called Tikkun Olam, to fix the world. And you don't fix the world without personal risk. So yeah, I will lose readers. I'm sure I'll lose readers.
What she intends to gain? A collection of essays from top writers with something new to say about a military occupation 50 years in the making. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Jerusalem.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, some Afghan rockers try to make their rock star dreams come true.
We thought it would be very cool to have the first rock band of Afghanistan play with the ultimate rock band of the world, which is Metallica.
It's a long shot, but can they turn their dreams into reality? Find out coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A lot of ink and airtime has been spent recently on the harsh tone of the current presidential campaign, the attacks, the smears, the hateful comments. Usually we're talking about what the candidates are saying, but it's not just them. Journalist Julia Yaffe recently wrote a profile of Donald Trump's wife, Melania. It was published in GQ a couple of days ago. And since then, Yaffe has been barraged with insults and threats, many of them violent and many of them anti-Semitic.
Basically, I woke up yesterday morning to find that the Daily Stormer, which is a white supremacist website, wrote a piece saying that I had attacked Empress Melania, the wife of their glorious leader. Those are their words, not mine. And they basically asked everybody to send me a tweet saying how it made them feel. So basically all day yesterday, I was getting some pretty vile images in my email, in my Twitter feed, you know, caricatures of Jews being shot execution style, you know, a Back to the Future poster redone as Back to the Oven, suggesting that I would look good on a lampshade.
Yeah, I mean, it's really horrifying. That white power organization, were they kind of like the Troller Zero, the first to strike?
Yeah, I think they were the ones who basically sent... sorry, my computers. I'm sorry. As we're talking, I'm just getting all of these. This is what it's been like for the last...
You're getting more...
Anyway.
Wow.
So, sorry, ask me that last...
Yeah.
This is what it's been like. So ask me again.
Yeah. So was that a white power organization? They were the Troller Zero, the first to strike at you?
Yes. And they did that because Melania Trump wrote a post on Facebook expressing displeasure with unnamed inaccuracies in my piece, and saying that I had invaded her family's privacy. So this white supremacist organization reproduced Mrs. Trump's Facebook post and basically asked people to come tell me how they feel. The tweets are, while disgusting and egregious, what has been weirder have been the phone calls that I've been getting even late into the night about inquiring about the inquiries I supposedly left about caskets and homicide cleanups at my house.
Wow. So, I mean, are you worried? Because, I mean, some of them sound like, imply, are death threats.
I mean, it's unpleasant to be sure, but, you know, I've gotten blowback for my pieces online before. You know, as a journalist, this is what comes with the territory. This is just, you know, going after my religion and ethnicity. And the volume and the way that basically a whole army seems to have been snapped into action is more disconcerting to me than the specific phone calls. Because it makes me think that, you know, given Donald Trump's hostility to the press, suggesting that we loosen our libel laws so it's easier to go after journalists, you know, getting people at his rallies to boo at the press, constantly vilifying journalists. And while we have to have thick skins because of the nature of our profession, you know, and I'll get through this and I'll be fine. The question is, what does this imply for our country and the healthiness of our public discourse and the freedom of our press?
It's implied in your article that Melania Trump knew you were writing this story for GQ. She is the wife of the top-running Republican presidential candidate. Do you know what inaccuracies she's talking about?
Well, of course we talked to Mrs. Trump before we published the story. The story was thoroughly fact-checked. The GQ legal team went over it. We even had lawyers in Slovenia look at this piece. We really shook this thing up and beat it up to make sure that we were all 100% confident in every word of the story. We have yet to hear from the Trump campaign what inaccuracies they're talking about. The only thing that that Mrs. Trump did mention explicitly to me was that she believed I was invading her family's privacy. I can understand that. She is an intensely private person. And, you know, I think that as uncomfortable as it is for her, and I know that this was one of the reasons she wasn't so hot on the idea of her husband running for president, this unfortunately is what comes with the territory of being the wife of the presumptive Republican nominee.
The profile of her, it may be cheeky in its style, but it's not unflattering. And at the end of your article in GQ, you quote one of Melania's rare lines from The Stump. As you may know by now, when you attack him being Trump, he will punch back 10 times harder. Do you have any reason to suppose this is what's happening to you right now?
I don't think and I don't know that Melania Trump sent these anti-Semitic trolls to my virtual doorstep. But she did express displeasure with my article. She named me. And this is what happened. And this has happened to other journalists before me, and I'm sure it'll happen again.
Julia Yaffe, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Julia Yaffe there telling us about the threats and insults she's received since her profile of Melania Trump was published by GQ. As she noted in one of her tweets, her family arrived in the U.S. 26 years ago from the Soviet Union. They were fleeing anti-Semitism. Julia Yaffe is also a contributor to Foreign Policy and the New York Times. Life is far from normal right now in Venezuela. Widespread shortages of pretty much everything, from food to toilet paper. Triple-digit inflation. A massive shortage of energy as well, which means frequent blackouts. And if that wasn't enough, a serious crime problem is way up. The opposition blames the socialist government of President Nicolas Maduro and has launched a recall drive aimed at removing Maduro from office. Put it all together, and pretty much every aspect of life in Venezuela is affected. Take something a lot of families might do for fun, like going to your local multiplex to watch a movie. That's getting harder and harder to do. Raul Stolk wrote about that recently for the website Caracas Chronicles. Raul is a Venezuelan writer based in Miami.
Last week, the government just implemented one extra measure, which basically says that every city in the country except the capital is going to have four-hour scheduled daily cuts of power. It would be like your whole city goes or different sections of the city go on a blackout for 4 hours, and some unscheduled cuts will happen. Well, that's what the government said. So the multiplexes have to sort of juggle around the times that they could screen their movies. So I'm not sure that they are even getting two screenings a day right now. Wow. Probably, if they're lucky, one. But, you know, this has been a crazy week, actually.
Why has it been such a crazy week?
Well, because we're looking at the crumbling, the final crumbling of the power grid in Venezuela. The government also said that starting this week, public employees will only work 2 days a week. So they're going to have a five-day weekend. I know this sounds like some sort of satire news thing, but, you know, it just happened.
Well, five-day weekend would be pretty cool if you could go to the movies,
yes,
but if you can't do that.
Yes, but you can't go to the movies. And the whole idea of the people having these five-day weekends is that less power is going to be consumed. But ask yourself, what are you going to do if you have a five-day weekend in a country where, you know, people prefer to stay at home because it is too dangerous in the streets? So people's just going to stay at home, you know, using power, playing with their PlayStations and or watching TV, or I don't know.
Yeah, so, something you just mentioned. I mean, I hear that movie ticket sales are down also because no one wants, yes, to be out on the street at night.
You know, Caracas was also, it was like New York. It was a city that didn't sleep. 5 years ago, it had an excellent nightlife. But right now, if you go out to the street at 6 o'clock, you will notice in a city that used to be completely chaotic, you will see that there's like no one in the streets. It's like a ghost town.
What do people do for fun at night?
People mostly stay at home, visit each other, maybe try to, you know, wait until dawn to go back to their homes.
Because of the crime?
Yes, because of the crime. You know, it's gone completely haywire. Yeah, it's like a war zone. These past 2 weeks, where the process of the recall referendum against Maduro started, which could end up with the ousting of Maduro. The thing is that this week, with the new electricity, energy-saving power cuts, there's been a lot of rioting and a little looting. Right now, it's a very tense situation in Venezuela. So when you ask me, what are people doing now for fun? Well, they're just not having fun. That right now, it's just a tense moment, very complicated moment in Venezuela.
What is showing in movie theaters tonight in Caracas? Like, people are not having fun, so maybe a little something to distract them. What's big right now?
Hollywood films are always big in Caracas right now. Leonardo Vigas's film Desde Allá will be screening soon.
What's the title of it?
It's called Desde Allá. Yeah, it's a complicated film. It explores sexuality and emigration. And, you know, you have so many Venezuelans emigrating from the country, starting lives at other places.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe not uplifting, but certainly timely. Raul Stolk, a Venezuelan writer, speaking with us from Miami. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
So maybe you're heading out for a movie and a drink tonight, and you're planning to hit your favorite night spot for that cocktail. I like the mojitos at this Venezuelan place just down the road from us. We're going farther afield for this next story, though, to Mexico, to meet a man who may be Mexico's oldest bar owner. Our guide is the world's Monica Campbell.
Don Javier?
Bienvenido. Está en su casa.
We're in the town of Tequila, about an hour outside Guadalajara. a mecca for the liquor. Stores line cobblestone streets selling it. It's pretty touristy. But I'm here to meet Javier Delgado Corona, or Don Javier. He's 93, more or less, he says. And for decades, he's run a small bar known as La Capilla, the chapel. But if you go there, don't look for a sign outside.
Porque capilla es para ir a adorar a Dios.
He says he doesn't like that name. It's just one that stuck. Don Javier is Catholic, and a chapel is where you go to praise God, not to drink. Inside, the bar is simple. Adobe walls keep it cool. There's white plastic chairs and tables, photos of friends.
Y pido a Dios que ustedes no se vayan decepcionados, porque pues de bonito no tiene nada.
When we walk in, he says, I hope you're not disappointed. It's not so pretty. He's modest. The place has plenty of character, much of it because of Don Javier. A British magazine ranked La Capilla 16th in its list of the world's 50 best bars. They said the place is as earthy as agave and that every bartender should meet Don Javier. As we talk, his nephew hands him his preferred drink.
¿Qué está tomando? What are you drinking?
Un tequila con Coca-Cola al tiempo.
Tequila with Coke at room temperature. But what most people order here is his signature drink, the Batanga. He started making it in the 1950s. Nothing fancy, just something refreshing on a hot day. First, he says, get a tall glass.
Ya lo escarchamos con limón. Ahora vamos a escarchar con la sal.
He then coats the rim with lime and large salt crystals, adds ice.
Ponle limón.
Squeeze some lime juice.
Next is Coke and plenty of tequila. Don Javier prefers Blanco, unaged tequila. Then he stirs. This is a crucial step. He stirs it with a big, old, wooden-handled knife.
El que le da el sabor es el cuchillo.
He says the knife gives it flavor. It's seasoned, he says, after years of using it to cut limes, chiles, avocados. He also talks about how this town, tequila, has changed.
Tequila era más chiquito. Si usted se fijó, casas con cocheras hasta para dos, tres carros, albercas y todo, todo.
It was much smaller. Now it's bustling, he says, with mansions in the hills, many owned by tequila bosses. But he's also seen how technology has changed cantina life.
La tecnología ha venido a trastornar todo. A veces me extraña que venga una pareja y se sienten a tomar su vinito.
Couples come in, stare at their phones. They're not talking to each other, he says. As he sips his drink, a band walks in. I ask Don Javier to request a favorite song. He picks, Cuando salgo a los campos, when I go to the fields. As they play, his eyes well up. What he misses most are the regulars, his friends. Most are dead. But he appreciates the tourists that come through, and vows he'll always stick to his philosophy of what makes the perfect bar.
Sonreírle, saludarle, donde te quieres sentar.
Smile when someone walks in, greet them, ask them where they want to sit, and get them a cool drink in a clean glass. He also sees his customers this way.
Amigos, no. No podemos ser amigos.
We're not friends, he says. We're more than friends. We're brothers in this world. For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, Tequila, Mexico.
Okay, I'm a little skeptical of that Coke and tequila business, but I'll stay in and try it tonight. You can too. We've got a recipe for Don Javier's Batanga cocktail up at PRI.org. Cheers. From Kabul to California in search of rock royalty that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, and I'm here with Nina Porzucchi. She's one half of The World in Words, our podcast about language. And this week on the podcast, it's all about pronunciation and places.
That's right. This is part of our occasional series, Name Tag, the stories behind place names.
Yeah, I'm surrounded by the bad way to pronounce names here in Massachusetts, like Peabody is one that always gets me. It's not like the character in Bullwinkle. It's Peabody.
Oh, God. But it's not just here in Massachusetts. No, Marco, actually, I have a little quiz for you today. So I'm going to spell out the names of a few villages in Norfolk, England. And I want to see...
And that's pronounced Norfolk? Okay.
No. That's a good point. And I want to see if you can pronounce them.
Okay.
So I want everybody also listening to play along.
Go ahead.
Are you ready?
Yep.
P-O-S-T-W-I-C-K.
Yeah, well, you could call that a compound word, post-wick. I'm going to say post-wick.
Posick. See how
we're
going? 0 for 1.
This is how
not
it's going to go.
Not doing so well. We're just going to do 2 more.
Okay.
H-A-P-P-I-S-B-U-R-G-H.
It could be Happisburg. It could be Happisburg. I'm going to say Happisburg.
You're never going to guess this in a million years. Haysbro.
No way.
Doesn't look like it at all.
They got to go by a Z.
I know. So those are two in Norfolk, England. Finally, I'm going to just give you a town that's a little closer to home here in New England. It's way up in New Hampshire, right near the Canadian border. It's spelt B-E-R-L-I-N.
All right. This is my neighborhood. I think I know this. It's not Berlin. It's Berlin.
Yes. Ding, 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 ding. It is Berlin.
And the bells go crazy.
Berlin, New Hampshire. There's also actually a Berlin, Massachusetts.
That's and Berlin, Massachusetts.
Berlin, Massachusetts,
Berlin.
Not Berlin,
right.
Massachusetts. Emphasis on the first syllable. And this week on the podcast, we go on a quest to figure out why Berlin has that funny pronunciation. So I went up to the little town, and let's just say that there are many, many theories about how they got their pronunciation.
I know around World War I, there was a huge anti-German movement. So I think Berlin probably got this pronunciation at that time. It's a kind of attempt to diminish the Germanic impression. But I don't know.
I'm going to say it probably generated from the French, you know, because the French population here back in the day, everybody settled down from Canada. So I'm going to say probably because of that, maybe that's why it's called what it is, maybe.
I guess it depends on where you're from and what your accent's all about, though. Because I'm like, I used to live in Bangor, and a lot of people from out of town call it Banger. But Berlin, I don't know. I guess it just depends on where you're from.
Yeah, I guess it does depend on where you're from. But are any of those theories kind of getting to it?
No. To hear the real story, you're just going to have to listen to the podcast, because my time is up.
Right. So where can we get said podcast?
You can subscribe to The World in Words on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Nina Porzucchi, thank you.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Here's a question that might stump some of you. Name the American heavy metal band that's one of the biggest, most influential in the Middle East and Afghanistan. Ready? Metallica. The band's popularity in the region plays a big role in a new feature film called Radio Dreams. In it, the bandmates of Metallica are urged to jam with Afghanistan's first rock band, Kabul Dreams, at a TV and radio station in San Francisco. Here's a clip where one of the Afghan musicians is leaving a message on Metallica's voicemail.
I have left a few messages today for you and wanted to check in with you about the TV station's interview request with Metallica, and also to reconfirm that the band will be arriving at the station today sometime between 4 and 6.
Between 4 and 6? A 2-hour window for a rock band? Ooh, I smell trouble. Not to worry, Radio Dreams is not a documentary. It'll be screening at the San Francisco International Film Festival tonight. Marjane Mogimi is the film's producer, and Mohamed Talani stars in the film. Welcome to you both. Hello.
Thank you very much for having us.
Hello, thank you so much.
Mohamed, let me start with you. This role comes to you pretty easily, I'd imagine, since you're also a member of the Iranian rock band Kiosk. Kiosk used to be a mainstay on Tehran's underground rock scene. Do you remember how you managed to hear Metallica for the first time? Because it's not the kind of music you'd expect to just walk into any store in Tehran and purchase.
Yeah, it was one of my friends handed me a tape of them, and then that was it. That was the beginning.
And Marjane, as a producer, have you been a lifelong Metallica fan?
Not really. I mean, I like their music and I listen to their music, but the reason we decided to go with Metallica was because of the influence they have on rock musicians and basically all musicians in the Middle East. We thought it would be very cool to have the first rock band of Afghanistan play with the ultimate rock band of the world, which is Metallica. So that's why we chose Metallica.
I don't want to give away the end of the film, but can you tell us how well Metallica cooperated in getting this film to the screen? Because they've been some of the most vocal opponents of music piracy, and I just wonder if they were worried how their music would be employed in Radio Dreams.
Actually, I have to say we had the easiest time with the managers and the agents of Metallica. And Lars was just extremely friendly. And
Lars Ulrich.
And Lars Ulrich. I don't want to give the ending, so I just speak about Lars. He was just so gracious. He had done so much homework beforehand. So when he came on board, he knew all about Cobble Dreams music. He was extremely gracious. We were like really super surprised to see how easy it was to work with them and with Metallica in general.
What did Lars Ulrich tell you about the idea for this movie in the first place? I mean, he did some homework, you said, but was he at all surprised with how popular Metallica is and these kind of unexpected Metallica hotspots?
Actually, Mohammed has a very nice conversation about some of the myth about Metallica, and especially about Lars. I'll let Mohammed tell you the story about the coin.
Oh, yeah.
What did you discuss with Lars Ulrich?
There was this story back in Iran that Metallica's drummer could, with his sticks, he can roll a coin against the wall, and the coin can stay there because he can roll pretty fast. And I asked him if he could. He said, well, it's great great to have that story about me, but I doubt if I can do it.
Did he give it a go?
No, he asked me if I could, and I said, I would if I was a drummer.
Yeah, that would be a pretty cool bar trick. You'd probably make a lot of money if you could do that.
Yeah, I know.
Well, Mohammed Talani and producer Marjaneh Moghimi, thanks very much for telling us about the making of Radio Dreams. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Cobble Dreams takes us out on this Friday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.